KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's opening forum hour with the World Water Forum meeting taking place in Mexico, and this being World Water Day, we're going to look at the planet's precious resource as we discuss the controversy over private versus public control of water, the effects of climate change on water as a resource, the question of whether or not access to safe water ought to be a human right, and the ongoing struggle over water for the world's poor. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Delegates from 121 countries met in Mexico City for the 7-day Fourth World Water Forum, where the goal this year was to improve water access for the poor. There were demonstrations against privatization, dam projects, and water extraction from impoverished Indian communities. The poor pay vastly more to private corporations today than they did when the first Global Water Forum of 1997 was held in Marrakesh. According to the United Nations World Water Development Report, the world will need 55% more food by the year 2030, which means increasing demand for irrigation, which already consumes nearly 70% of all fresh water consumed for human use. One-third of the world population lives in water-stressed countries, and by 2025, that figure is expected to rise to two-thirds. In most regions, water quality is declining. Most of us may believe in safe, affordable water and sanitation for all people, but how to reach 1.1 billion without safe water and what to do about the 2.6 billion who are without sanitation? On this World Water Day, UNESCO has raised the central theme of water and culture, and we want to focus in this hour a forum on key questions of what many view as one of our most precious and vital resources. Let me tell you who is joining us. I want to welcome here in studio Peter Glick, who is president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Also glad to have with us this morning by phone Winona Howder, who is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch and was in Mexico City for the forum and joins us from the nation's capital. Good morning to you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jeff Siegel, who is Washington-based but joins us from Cincinnati. He's Director of Government Reform with the Reason Foundation. Welcome, Jeff Siegel.
Oh, thank you.
Also, we're going to be joined by Jamal Sagir for just a brief Q&A. He's Director for Energy and Water with the World Bank, and he's going to tell us some things from his perspective, and glad to have you here, Jamal Sagir.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to have you. Let me begin with you. What came out of the 7-day forum?
I think this was an important World Water Forum this year where many issues have been discussed. What came very clear is that integrated water resource management, which means looking at all aspects of water, is an important aspect of the water agenda. This is an important aspect. The second aspect, which came very clear, that as we go on different various agendas of water, multi-sectorial approach, multi-stakeholder processes are important. In other words, consulting with different people, getting the communities involved, talk to the different NGOs is an important aspect on the water agenda as we look at the scarcity that we've seen around the world.
So a lot of emphasis on moving local and I presume moving toward better governance and on combining or linking water issues, that is water for agriculture, water for people, water for industry, water for growth.
Absolutely, but you have to hold also water for energy security, which is an important aspect. The relation between water for growth, water for development, and energy security is an important as we look at the climate change issue and adaptability.
What about innovations, though, that are going to come? There's been some criticism in the past of these World Water Forums that nothing really concrete or specific in the way of an agenda was accomplished. What do you see as coming out of this?
In terms of innovation, I think what is very important, what the interesting aspect of innovation is sharing the knowledge that comes from different parts of the world. So innovation, that doesn't necessarily mean you only bring a new idea. Sharing new ideas between South Asia, Africa, bringing different ways of looking at the water issues, communities involvement, how do you put options, how do you get the stakeholder involved, how do you get the mayors of the municipalities being more convinced that water is as important as anything else, how you make that sanitation, the forgotten orphan of the water sector, is looked at seriously by many people. I think an important aspect that is coming this year is that water is an important item of the growth agenda and the path out of poverty. And I think this is an important aspect. As you know, it is estimated that 4 billion people, one half of the world population, will live under condition of severe water stress in 2025, with conditions particularly severe in Africa, Middle East, and South Asia. So this is very important that you have to think that the poorest country and the poorest people who are the most directly affected by water quality and water scarcity issues.
In these impoverished countries, though, where water is scarce, you can dig wells, but if there's no electricity to pump the water, you have to ask, what good does it do? And we can provide clean water systems, but in many of these countries, corruption is endemic. How long will these systems last?
But first of all, I think the link that you have made just right now between electricity and water is very important. 70% of the water costs are coming from pumping the water. So the electricity is very important to be able to pump the water, to distribute the water. And that's another aspect that we don't talk about. It's very important. It's the link between water, electricity. Now, the issue of governance of the sectors from the utility side, whatever public or private, doesn't matter. One important statistic, over 50% in average of the poor are usually not connected to any network, whatever public or private. They buy the water from private tankers and they pay as much as 10% higher from either public or private tariff that are put in place. That's an important aspect to keep in mind. The poorest that are not connected, that means they don't receive any subsidy by the tariff structure that is usually offered by the utilities.
Jamal Sagir is Director of Energy and Water with the World Bank. And just one more question before I let you go, Mr. Sagir, and again, appreciate your being with us. World Bank, where do you stand now on dam building? There's certainly been a lot of controversy around that whole issue.
First of all, it's very important to realize that the hydropower development is an important aspect of the development agenda. If you look at the development of the hydropower in the developed country, 80% of the OECD country, which means the industrialized and developed country, have harnessed all their hydropower. Less than 20% of the developing country have harnessed their hydropower. Less than 8% of Africa, huge potential hydropower, have been harnessed. And in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, less than 8% have access to electricity, and less than 50% have access to clean water supply and sanitation. What I'm trying to say is building hydropower, building dam, reservoir, is an important aspect for hydropower development, for energy security, for food security, for power security. However, building dam is very important to take into account full environmental, economic, social effect during the design, the pre-design, and implementation. So it's not a question of building only hydropower for sake of building dam, but you have to take into account safeguard policy, and that's what in the World Bank we try to do and we plan to do.
Jamal Sagir, again, is Director for Energy and Water of the World Bank. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joined us from the nation's capital, and Winona Hodder is also with us from the nation's capital this morning. She's Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and you were also in Mexico City. I don't think you were as quite as sanguine as we heard from Mr. Sagir. I think you called it a dry forum, a water forum that was dry.
Yes, I think the most interesting thing in Mexico City wasn't the Fourth World Water Forum, but it was all of the events that were going on around it. For instance, the 25,000 people who marched the first day of the Water Forum, marching towards the forum to protest the World Bank's policies, building dams, the trend towards privatization, and the inability of these big institutions who put on the water forums to really address problems. There were also many other meaningful events. For instance, the Mexican Coalition for the Right to Water, which is made up of hundreds of Mexican groups, sponsored an alternative forum that was attended by about 1,000 people from around the world. The Latin American Tribunal, which was sponsored by a number of non-governmental organizations, had a five-day event looking at different cases in Latin America where corporations had abused power and misused water. The Hopi Indians from New Mexico ran 1,500 miles to a indigenous peoples event in Mexico City. So there was a very rich mix of events going on, and I think that the World Water Forums have now graduated into the same type of controversy that we've seen when the World Bank meetings are held in Washington or the WTO meets.
With 25,000 demonstrating, it certainly rivals what you've just described. I'm wondering, though, about the whole ongoing controversy about private versus public control of water. I'm looking at a report by the American Enterprise Institute, and it says, we find that when controlling for water source, location, fixed effects, county income, urbanization, and year, there is little difference between public and private systems. And I think what we heard from Mr. Segura is that any way the water can get access, whether it's private or public or both, ought to be essentially implemented. What, I mean, you're pretty clearly more opposed to the private. Why?
Well, I think that the track record of the privates is actually very dismal. Almost universally, what we see are higher rates. We hear about the efficiency of the private water companies, but they usually achieve this efficiency by firing generally about half of the staff. We see lots of corruption associated with privatization. Privatization is often in the form of management contracts, and in order to be able to have access to these contracts, there's bribery and so forth. Companies aren't accountable to the consumers that they serve, but they tend to be accountable to their shareholders. And we have seen just around the world many cases of privatization failing. Manila, Philippines, Buenos Aires, Argentina, many cities in Bolivia, Jakarta, Indonesia, Puerto Rico, Johannesburg, South Africa. Even here in the United States, where privatization was supposed to be a wave of the future, we've seen that the private companies aren't able to get contracts in the big cities because of the failures and the controversy, and they now have to focus on small towns.
Well, here in the United States, notwithstanding places like Lexington, Kentucky, where there's control of utilities and all, the tax structure allows for the poor, it allows for everybody, really, to have user fees to pay for water. But the way to go is, it's being suggested at least by this World Water Forum, is more local. NGOs are talking about water as a human right. How can that be made the case locally, especially when you have, in some instances, such malfeasance as far as governance is concerned, and you don't have a tax structure like you have here?
Well, I think one of the things that NGOs are pushing for is a right to water and a UN convention that protects the right to water. Decentralization is fine, and that there needs to be local control, that localities need to have a big voice in how their water is provided, but pushing all of the responsibility down to the locality and not requiring national governments to provide water for their people is problematic. I think that one of the things that we need to see if we're going to be able to provide water for people is a different model of development. And in many of the countries where we've worked, where there are citizen groups opposing privatization, there actually are resources in the country that could provide water for people if they were being used properly. For instance, Ghana, where there's been a very controversial privatization. Ghana is a very wealthy country with lots of gold, produces a large amount of cocoa, but the International Monetary Fund has required the government to allow corporations to pay no taxes. So rather than being able to pay to provide their poor people water, that money is taken out of the country and goes to transnational corporations. So there's a lot more to providing water than just talking about financing and private companies providing financing.
Winona Howder, again, is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and she's with us from Washington. So is Jeff Siegel, who is Director of Government Reform with the Reason Foundation. By the way, we ought to mention that when we're talking about privatization of water, there's a huge, what is often called stealth privatization of bottled water that is massive in terms of consumption in places like China, Indonesia, and India. But, Jeff, you're pretty much on the side of a real role, at least an integral role, as you see it, for the private sector. But when you talk about water as a human right, like food, it kind of takes out the private sector, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, we all want the same things, and at least our macro-level goal. is the same. You know, we want clean water. We want folks to have access to water. The question really boils down to, well, what is the best way to deliver? What's the process and who delivers that service to make sure that, that people do have clean water, that they have access to it? And that's both domestically and internationally. To assume out or assume that the private sector shouldn't have a role simply because they are the private sector ignores their experience both, again, here in the United States and even internationally, especially places like Britain and Germany and France, where they've been wildly successful in generating access and improving water quality. You know, we look you know, and basically just say, well, look, can the private sector have a role? If yes, what is the appropriate role they should play? And let's make sure the proper governance structures and oversight is included to make sure that, that people are safeguarded. And if it is a human right, well, how's the best way to make sure that people can get access to water? You know, yes, have there been problems in some places? Absolutely. Is it always a panacea? Certainly not. But when we look at the roughly 2,500 projects that the World Bank has financed or is financing, only 3.5% of them have been canceled over time. This is a very small percentage. You know, certainly those 3.5% is end up being very high profile, and you know, it's a percentage figure that's higher than we'd like to see. We'd like to see 0% if we could, but generally speaking, it's a very high success rate. We've seen dramatic improvements in those other projects where the World Bank has been successful.
Speaking about 3.5%, I was looking at a figure. Well, actually, I should mention first about 300 million Africans lack access to safe drinking water, and certainly need irrigation, and there's going to be expected decrease in rainfall as well as increased demand, but only 3% of what's possibly there has been tapped, which suggests the need for diversification of economies, and it suggests global hydrological and trading systems. In other words, things that can be done with good governance and maybe some kind of private and public alliance.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when we look at where there has been high levels of success, it's not an entirely public system. It's not an entirely private system. There needs to be some sort of partnership where, you know, the public agencies have strong governance. They have a role, and perhaps they have a role in providing subsidies to make sure that water access is affordable, that rates and tariffs are low, so that way poverty-stricken areas are able to afford the water. I mean, you can build a gold-plated system that nobody can afford. But really, you know, again, the question is, well, what is the best way we can get there? And I do believe it is some form of partnership model where both the public and the private sector have a role to play, where we rely on the private sector's expertise, perhaps some of their capital, perhaps some of their, you know, innovation and other things they can bring to the table. But the public sector doesn't walk away. They need to be a strong partner. They need to have a role both in planning and development and especially oversight and accountability.
Jeff Siegel, again, is Director of Government Reform for the Reason Foundation. Peter Glick is here with us in studio. He's president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. This is a big issue, water availability worldwide. Now, Peter, no?
It's a huge issue, Michael. And first of all, happy World Water Day, such as it is. Once a year, at least, we bring some of these issues to the attention of the broader public. Water is a huge issue. We've heard a lot of different pieces of this already from the guests already. The failure to meet basic human needs for water, the lack of access to clean water and sanitation, international conflicts over water, climate change, water and energy, water and food. You think about it, and frankly, everything we really care about is to some degree tied up with
most of our planet, most of our body, as the old cliches would go. But you mentioned climate change. This is one of those more phantom issues in terms of the effect on water sources. I mean, loss of snowpacks now in the Sierra, and climate and weather changes will affect water access considerably.
Well, I would argue it already is. In to some degree, the hydrologic cycle that we learn about in elementary school, evaporation and formation of clouds and precipitation and runoff, is the climate cycle. And as we change the climate, as we're already doing, we're going to see higher temperatures. We're going to see changes in demand for water. We're going to see changes in when we get water and where we get it and the quality of water. And we're not prepared to think about those sorts of things. It's going to be a bigger and bigger issue over the coming decades. It's already a concern, I would argue, for places like California. It's going to make the broader issues of feeding the planet and meeting basic human needs for water more complicated.
You mentioned international border disputes. What are the big ones now?
Well, water is very widely shared. It's truly an international issue, although here in the United States, we don't think about that too much. We have very few neighbors. We tend to ignore them often. But even the Colorado River is shared between the U.S. and Mexico, not to mention the disputes among the seven states in the U.S. that share it. Part of the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes, of course, are shared by Canada. But in other parts of the world, international water issues are much more difficult. The Middle East, where every major river is shared, the Jordan is shared by Syria and Jordan and Lebanon and Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank. The Nile, believe it or not, is shared by 10 countries. We think of it as an Egyptian river, but Egypt's at the end of the pipeline, and there are nine nations upstream of Egypt. Many rivers in Southeast Asia, the Indus, the Ganges, Brahmaputra, all of these are shared internationally, and tensions are growing over allocations of those rivers.
Do you see much coming out of this Mexico forum, the seven-day meeting that took place?
Well, I have very mixed feelings about these international meetings. I've been to very many of them. They're a great opportunity for calling attention to these issues, for public theater to some degree, for real open discussions about major issues. But I'm less happy about what actually comes out of them. There are very few binding commitments on the part of international organizations to do new things. There are very few commitments on the part of national governments to do new things. And in all of the years that these meetings have been going on, the truth is there's still a billion people without access to clean drinking water. There's still 40% of the world's population that don't have access to adequate sanitation services, something you and I and our listeners pretty much take for granted, but that we can't take for granted. And we're not making the progress we need to make to solve those problems, and we're not getting progress out of these conferences.
But we hear this progress under the aegis of the World Bank. We hear this progress under the aegis of the United Nations. Is it just that small incrementally?
There are efforts, and I don't want to diminish the tremendous efforts that many people around the world are putting into these problems. But the commitments on the part of international organizations and national governments and frankly, local governments are not adequate to meet the needs. The UN has something called the Millennium Development Goals. There are a wide range of them designed to reduce poverty, and two of them are related to water. Two of them say we shall reduce by half by the year 2015 the proportion of people without access to sanitation and sanitation services and clean water. And we're not going to meet them given the commitments that have been made so far.
Well, I'm going to allow those of you listening to make a commitment to joining us. In fact, you're welcome to do that and cordially invited by phone. Our lines are open and available to you. And whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, we welcome your involvement in this conversation about water. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Extraordinary number of issues here, but join us if you have something you'd like to say. Again, it's toll-free 866-733-6786 for your calls. You can also join us by email, and our email address here is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. Talking with Peter Glick, who is president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, Winona Howder, executive director of Food and Water Watch, Jeff Siegel, who directs government reform for the Reason Foundation, and we spoke earlier and briefly with Jamal Saghir, director for energy and water with the World Bank. This is Forum, your calls and emails when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking on World Water Day about water, looking at the resource and looking at certainly ongoing controversies about privatization versus public control of water. We're talking with, talked earlier with Jamal Saghir, who is Director for Energy and Water with the World Bank. And with us this hour, Jeff Siegel, Director of Government Reform with the Reason Foundation, Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and Peter Glick here in studio, President and Co-Founder of the Pacific Institute. And you are welcome to join us at our toll-free number. We're going to go to your calls here forthwith. That number is 866-733-6786. Or you can also join us by email, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org. One of the things that we wanted to discuss and have been discussing here is what is generally characterized as the human right to water. And Peter Glick and I were talking a little bit about the fact that not only does the United States not recognize the human right to water, but human right to water, Peter, you were saying, doesn't mean necessarily free water.
I think there's very clearly a human right to water in international law, in the national constitutions, what's called customary international law. The UN issued in 2002 a very clear statement that there is a human right to water. It doesn't necessarily mean that water should be free, provided free, although governments have that choice. If they choose to subsidize water or provide it for free, they may. But the poor often pay, they're not only willing to pay for water, ironically, they often pay more for water than you and I probably pay for water, and of pretty dubious quality. And so I think the challenge is meeting basic human needs for drinking water in a way that meets everyone's needs and produces a sustainable system.
We go to your calls. And first caller, Marie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm not sure that this exactly pertains to what we're talking about, but my question was, and I'm not sure of the exact figures, but I know that about 70% of the water in this country, and I'm sure in other countries, is used to raise livestock for meat consumption. And I'm wondering what percentage or how that plays into this in South America and other countries where we buy meat from them, and they're using huge amounts of water to raise these livestock.
Some figures, Peter Glick?
Yeah, that's a great question. About 70% of the water that humans use worldwide goes to agriculture as a whole. Now, it takes much more water to grow livestock and to grow meat than it does to grow grain. On average, it takes about 1,000 tons of water to grow a ton of grain, but it may take 15,000 tons of water to grow a ton of cow, for example. And as the world increasingly moves toward a meat diet, China, India, many of the developing countries, interestingly, are eating more and more meat.
Not cows in India, however.
It's going to have enormous implications for water availability, for the amount of water that we need to grow the diets that we eat. And it is a critical part of this challenge.
I'm reminded of Jeremy Rifkin's book, where he pretty much breaks all this down in terms of statistics and says, you want a sustainable planet, going to go to grain. Let me thank Marie for her call and go to more of your calls. And we go next to Linda. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to address Jeff Siegel's comments about how we should look to the past of private sector involvement in all kinds of aspects of our lives. And I want to just remind the people listening that, you know, if you were to turn on your tap and get oil out of it from the private sector, you know, we could wind up with something like that if the private sector is in charge of our water. And he stated that there would be government oversight of private corporations and the private sector. And if he really believes that, and if the listening public believes that, I would say to them, I have a bridge to sell them, because we can see right now what the government oversight of corporations is. And the money that's wielded by corporations is so great that if they get full control of water, we are in big trouble.
What would you say, Jeff Siegel, to that kind of concern and apprehension about corporate control, mistrust of corporate control?
Well, you know, there is this natural apprehension and this natural mistrust of corporations, and I honestly don't understand it. Most water systems in the United States are publicly operated, and we have the exact same accountability mechanisms and performance requirements. Sometimes they're even greater when a private company operates a system. In fact, the US EPA has demonstrated time and time again that of water samples and of quality that you even cited a study that there is really no difference. Sometimes the privates actually work better. They provide a higher quality water system. Sometimes it's the same, and in a few cases they may lack.
Let me say, by the way, something else from that study, which is, again, was from a conservative institute, the American Enterprise Institute.
It was also a Brookings. It was an AEI Brookings study. I've seen it.
I'm looking at the executive summary here, and just for the record, they say public systems are somewhat more likely to violate the maximum levels of health-based contaminants allowed under the Safe Drinking Water Act, while private systems are somewhat more likely to violate monitoring and reporting regulations.
And that gets down to the governance issue, regardless of who is operating the system. Government has a role to play. They have the accountability mechanism if it's under a contractual arrangement. We need to make sure that the strong performance measures are in place, that they're being adhered to, that they require the corporation or the company to report, and that it's done publicly and transparently. We should be asking the same questions of our publicly operated systems. You know, are they being as transparent? Are they reporting the actual levels of contaminants?
Winona Hodder, let's hear from you on this.
Well, in actuality, the number that Jeff quotes, the 3.5%, I'd be interested to know where that comes from, because we have studied privatizations from around the world and would say that closer to 80% of the large privatizations have actually failed. And I think what happened here in Atlanta, Georgia, is a really good example. We have a very good regulatory system, much better than we see in the developed world, where the World Bank and other economic interests are pushing privatization. And Atlanta is kind of the story of what happens everywhere. First of all, the private company comes in with a very low bid. And so after they get the contract, they have to come back and ask the city for another $80 million. There was a little bit of competition over the contract, and in fact, one of the ways that United Water, which is a Suez company, one of the largest private water companies in the world, one of the ways that they got this contract was they gave a campaign contribution to the mayor's brother in North Carolina. So we see the same kind of activities that we do around getting contracts for other types of services. The way that United Water achieved their efficiency was they came in and they halved the number of employees and slashed the amount of training provided to the remaining employees. And so then what you had was a backlog of work orders and maintenance balloon for just about every piece of the system. And eventually this resulted in brown water and boil water days. And at the same time, United Water started hitting up the city for even more money. And eventually, after 3 years, the city had to get rid of the United Water contract. They even found that they had to hire their own accountant to look through the paperwork, and they found that United Water wasn't able to collect money as efficiently from the consumers. We see this over and over and over again, and what we do see is that we do have a public water system in the U.S., about 85%. It's not without problems, and what it takes is for the citizenry and the community to be involved and to help hold accountable. Any good public service has citizens involved in it. If we were really serious about providing water to the urban poor, there are a lot of things that we would do rather than force privatization. The tanker trucks that have been mentioned, the first thing that a country could do is to regulate those tanker trucks. But instead, the bank often goes in, brings in a bunch of consultants from the UK and from the US. They write a bunch of expensive studies, and a lot of money is wasted, and the country incurs more debt. And then when the privatization occurs, the sewage system that's promised or extending water to the poor just doesn't happen, because a private company, of course, has to watch out for its shareholders. So does it really want to extend service into the poorest part of the community, or doesn't it want to move into the part of the community where there are office buildings and businesses and a tourist industry? And I think that's where the bottom line is.
Peter Glick, you wanted to add.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is that we fail to meet basic human needs for water, and we're continuing to fail to meet those needs. And I wish we could move beyond this privatization debate, because private companies aren't going away in the water business. The entire country of England has a private water system. The United States has a dominantly public water system, and it works for the most part, as has been pointed out, pretty well. But there's still 30 or 40 million Americans who get their water from private water companies, and they're not going away. What we really want is we want efficient, cost-effective, reliable, high-quality water services delivered to us. And public or private, delivery of water is a monopoly. Because of that, it's got to be regulated by the government, as has been noted, and it's got to be regulated well and transparently and fairly. And that's really where
that's a
we're
big order.
That's where we're falling down. The problems we have, public or private, come from the failure of governments to properly regulate and the public to be adequately involved in decision making.
I want to go to more of your calls. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, it's toll free 866-733-6786 or by email forum, F-O-R-U-M at KQED.org. Harvey, morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael, and thanks for this great show. There's a solid-state device called a thermoelectric device, and it is used to precipitate water out of the air. They use it in solid-state dehumidifiers, but it can also be used to pull water out of the air and for drinking purposes. And there's a company called Hyflux, that's H-Y-F-L-U-X, that's www.hyflux.com, and they are a company that makes these thermoelectric water devices. Now, these, they can just be plugged in anywhere, and they look like a normal water cooler, except they just precipitate water out of the air, and then it goes through a filter, and you can drink it. Now, my idea, in a lot of countries where they don't have electricity, is that you can combine a solar panel with a thermoelectric device. The thermoelectric device works off DC, so does solar, and the sunlight will power the solar the thermoelectric device to precipitate water out of the air, and you can put places anywhere in countries where there's a lot of sunlight but not much water. That way they don't have to drill, they don't have to seek water from other corporations, and they can become independent. So it's Hyflux.com. That's the company to look at, and I think that's the way to go as far as the high-tech solution to our water problem on the planet today. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Harvey. Harvey's been consistently our sort of resident solar advocate through the years, and also that new technology. You know something about that, Peter Glick?
Well, here's the broader issue. The broader issue is that there are lots of ways of finding water at various expense, at various costs, and I'm sure there are lots of high-tech technical solutions. Some people think desalination is the ultimate answer. The truth is the answer varies from place to place. There are different amounts of water available of different qualities in different places, and the kind of high-tech system that Harvey describes might be appropriate in some place. But there are other places where the truth is there's plenty of water, but we're wasting the water that we already use, and improving efficiency may be the answer. In some places, smart groundwater management may be the answer. We don't want to look for a single answer. What we want to look for is smart, integrated solutions that are appropriate for the places that we need those solutions.
Speaking about being appropriate for the places, I referenced Jeff Siegel, Lexington, Kentucky. That's a kind of anomalous and interesting example.
Well, Lexington is one of about 15% of the U.S. population, which is served by a where water and wastewater utilities are operated and actually owned by a private utility. They are private regulated utilities. There are a number, like I said, 15% of the U.S. population is served this way, where the public has had no role in building the system. They regulate it just like any other utility. And it's not necessarily an increasing trend in the sense that that domestically we're pretty well built out with our infrastructure. We're not seeing many new utility systems being built, but those that are private regulated utilities remain so.
I'm going to go to some of your emails here. This is from a listener named Robert, who says, after the Enron debacle, it's easy to understand the distrust of private control over something that should be a basic human right, like water or electricity. If there is private control of water, I would hope that it is heavily regulated by the government. Here's Eric, who writes, according to the American Water Works Association, 59% of urban water is applied to landscapes, and most landscapes get twice the amount of water that they actually need. Two bills in the California Assembly seek to regulate irrigation devices. Irrigation equipment will be required to meet standards for water efficiency. The public should learn more about equipment that already meets the requirement at www.irrigation.org. And another listener writes, it's hard to believe anyone who reads newspapers and listens to the radio news, as well as going through electricity shortages during our time of electricity being handed over to private corporations, would think that giving over the public water supply to private corporations would be a good idea. Keep control of our water in the public venue. And another listener, Laura, writes, thanks so much for the call from the person asking about water usage, meat versus grain. I would love to hear this issue explored in depth. This has always been my pet reason for not eating meat when I do that. 1 ton pound versus 15 tons pound water usage, how much nutrition and impact? Well, that's maybe for another day. We want to get to more of your calls here, and let's do that. And let's welcome John. Good morning.
Yes. First, about this drought in Africa, in East Africa specifically, there's several countries here that are upstream of the Nile, and all of this water flows into Egypt, but it originates in some of these southern African countries, East African countries. And I'd hope to bring attention to everyone listening to help bring pressure to renegotiate what was done. We helped build that dam, I think it's the Aswan Dam in Egypt, right after colonial times. Now, this has locked all of these countries into this horrible situation. Somebody needs to put more pressure on the situation with Egypt. But I have a question that, is it probably because we don't want to upset Egypt, which would then upset Israel, because that would potentially upset that balance? And my second point is that I hope that some of these environmental groups that go to sub-Saharan Africa would realize that stopping some of these dam projects is not in these countries' interest, because you're just setting these people up to be encroached on by the rest of the world, which will need more and more energy, and you're stopping their development. And a lot of these African countries need to bring television out to their rural areas instead of just their cities.
John, you raise a number of, I think, salient points. And let me defer here to Winona Howder, because you might want to comment, Winona Howder. We haven't heard you comment yet on the role of the World Bank in terms of dams and dam building, international pressure. I mean, he raises a whole question with the Aswan Dam in Egypt about the role of Middle East politics. But maybe a more pertinent question here is just what kind of international pressure can really be brought to bear. And, again, what the World Bank's role ought to be, especially in something like dam building.
Well, the World Bank is, again, promoting the building of large dams. And I think it's important to know that of the world's 40 richest countries, only one is more than 90% hydro-dependent. And of the world's 40 poorest, 15 are more than 90% hydro-dependent. There have been numerous drought-induced blackouts and energy rationing in hydro-dependent companies. And just because there's a large hydro dam doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to solve problems for the population. These centralized projects tend to target primarily the large landowners on the most fertile soils, and they also target industry and urban populations. These dams have caused massive social and environmental damage. They've forced an estimated 40 to 80 million people off the land. And what we think is important, if we are to begin to meet the Millennium Development Goals, is that the small farmers who produce about two-thirds of the world's food on rain-fed land, they have to be at the front and the center of global water policy, and they need support for decentralized water storage and the sustainable use of groundwater. And we see wonderful projects like one in India that a group called Karen Bharat Singh is putting together, and they've built thousands of small reservoirs to harvest rainfall. But what happens is that these decentralized, low-cost approaches to water supply that really help people, they're not commercially or politically very popular. They don't make the big construction companies money. They don't offer export contracts. So we think that we need to completely re-examine this new policy of the World Bank to go back to dam building.
Let me bring more of our callers on. Cassandra, thank you for waiting. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to follow up that last comment with an endorsement of rainwater harvesting. I live in Sonoma County. I have also a home in Mill Valley, and in Sonoma County, I have terrible water quality where the water is polluted by both boron and sodium. And the fact of the matter is that I can collect off of my roof more than enough water to water all of my landscaping. And yet the technology for doing that is almost inaccessible in the United States. Yet in India and in Australia, people routinely collect rainwater off of their roofs, and they use it for household consumption.
Peter Glick?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think we're not set up to use some of the traditional approaches that can provide us more benefits than we realize. California's a tough place to do rainwater harvesting because, of course, we don't get much rain from April through October. But in many parts of the world, rainwater harvesting is a critical issue. It's got to be done more. And even in the United States, I agree, we should think about where it's appropriate and how to permit it.
Here's a listener from Munich, Germany, who tells us that she received the Pacific Institute's email about today's program and hooked up via the internet and says, I'm currently working on a thesis about freshwater resource understandings in Canada, the paradigm changes over the past 40 years and the implementation into Canadian policies. What I'm interested in now is an opinion on the question if there will be any time soon that water exports from Canada to the United States.
Very sensitive issue. The Canadians are very nervous about the United States for lots of reasons, perhaps, but we share the Great Lakes. They get very upset whenever we talk about taking more water out of the Great Lakes, and we have an international agreement that's supposed to govern that. I do not see a time when there will be significant exports of water from Canada to the United States for two reasons. One is politics. The other is it costs a lot to move water very far. And the reality is it would cost too much to move water from Canada to where we really need it, which is in the southwestern U.S. We have other options that are available to us that are more cost-effective, more environmentally clean and acceptable, and less politically controversial.
Here's one more question from Tomas. Will water limit population growth? According to demographers, our global population of 6+ billion will double to 12 in this century and then stabilize because it will be unable to grow any further. What a shame. Wouldn't it be better to manage our population growth as well as our water resources, as well as air, land, mineral, and forest resources?
Well, there's no doubt that all of the problems we face are worse with a bigger population than a smaller population, including especially water, because there's a fixed amount of water on the planet, and the more water, the more people we have, the less water per person there is.
I once got a lot of angry email because I said that population is probably the number one environmental problem, but when you think of consumption, I'm afraid I still stand by that statement.
It's the combination, of course. I would say that water's not going to limit population. What's going to happen is population's going to grow, and where we have water problems, we're not going to be able to solve problems of poverty and human health. And so water is a constraint, not on population, but really on quality of life.
On we go to more of your calls. Tony, thanks for joining us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi. It's been a fascinating discussion this morning, and a couple things really ring with me. One, that the issue is multifaceted, and what I would love to see is us focus on, you know, what we call the low-hanging fruit, the problems that are more easily addressable. There are, you know, hundreds of millions of the billion people without clean water, where the answer is often lies below in the aquifer, maybe 30 feet or 100 feet below them. And there are a group of nonprofits that are, you know, focused on this issue. I've been working with Water Partners, and to date they've done 83 projects. All are still in operation. They go into a village, and they get everybody in the village to buy off on the project. The people in the village will do the work, help dig the wells with some outside help in skills and equipment, and actually dig their own latrines, and those people are trained to maintain the system. It's community-owned, so you sort of skirt the public-private issue. The problem is that it's not something that's going to attract a lot of money, and that's been that's probably been the biggest issue for this group. But for the life of me, as I look around at the world, it's hard for me to understand why people and governments aren't rallying to solve that issue for the low-hanging fruit. Most of these nonprofits have budgets of a couple million dollars. And, you know, Water Partners has served 100,000 people to this point. And it seems like such a no-brainer approach. It's worked for... And, you know, I would love to see more focus on that.
All right. Yeah, Peter Glick, you want to...
Yeah, just a quick comment. There are a number of great nonprofit organizations, Water Partners, Water for People, Rotaries in this area, WaterAid in England and now in the U.S., they're doing great work working with local communities to solve local water problems. But as Tony says, it's a not to make a pun here, but it's a drop in the bucket, and we're not going to solve this problem without much greater commitment, not only from these NGOs that are doing great work, but from governments, because it's such a massive problem.
Let me thank Tony for the call, and we've got seconds left here. Maybe a quick final word from you, Winona Hodder, about how things look and where particular emphasis ought to lie?
Well, I think it's exciting that there is a huge social movement that is growing in momentum to help address world water problems. And I'd like to urge people to go to our website, foodandwaterwatch.org, and you can link up to some of these organizations around the world that are focused on water.
Jeff Siegel, want to give your final word here and website?
Well, our website's simply reason.org, and you know, it's been a fascinating conversation, one that I've had with Peter and Winona before, and you know, I do think there is a role for the private sector to play, and it's one that we can, if we embrace, we can improve access and water quality around the world.
Well, on that optimistic note, thank you all for your involvement in this program. I'm talking, of course, of our guests as well as our listeners. Appreciate your being with us here Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank Jamal Saghir, Director for Energy and Water with the World Bank, whom we spoke to earlier. Thank Jeff Siegel, Director of Government Reform with the Reason Foundation, Winona Hodder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and Peter Glick, President and Co-Founder of the Pacific Institute. Our thanks also to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Tom Kromkowski. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.